I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. On May 26 to 28 at Stanford University Law School, the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies hosted a conference with the Stanford Center for Law and Biosciences and the Center for Cognitive Liberty and Ethics on human enhancement technologies and human rights. We opened the conference with a mini debate between Ron Bailey from Reason Magazine and the author of Liberation Biology, William Hurlbut from the President's Council on Bioethics, and Eric Davis, who's an independent writer and culture critic. We're going to be listening to Eric's talk this afternoon. He's a very interesting writer and speaker. He's a San Francisco-based person. He wrote Technosis, Myth, Magic, and Mysticism in the Age of Information. He's contributed to Zigzag Zen, Buddhism and Psychedelics, and the Disinformation Book of Lies. He's written widely on culture for many different publications, Book Forum, The Wire, Artbyte, LA Weekly, and so forth. And he stakes out kind of a middle ground in this debate between techno-optimism about human enhancement technologies and the techno-pessimism that was represented by Bill Hurlbut. So, Eric Davis.
I must sort of ask your forgiveness from the outset because I am not going to proceed with normative concerns. I'm not particularly interested in entering into the full debate that is going to be raging here throughout the weekend. There's a sort of a problem with debates. They tend to proceed through binaries where we make certain arguments, we ask people to accept or refute our claims. We sort of draw people onto a kind of a boxing ring where folks are having it out. And there's always this sort of implication that your own decision making is kind of at stake. You're supposed to be cold one way or the other. Of course, this is a necessary part of human life, but it's not really what I'm interested in here. What I'm interested in trying to do is to articulate or draw a space within which all of us here, and those of us outside of this room, millions of us, will be engaged in these issues in a way that's difficult, frustrating, confusing, ambivalent, ambiguous, and potentially enlightening, and enlightening in a very specific sense. What I'm sort of trying to put a name over the space that I'm trying to describe is the phrase, the post-human condition. Now, what do I mean by the post-human condition? Well, let's just back up. You know, there's a lot to be said about the concept of the human condition, where it came from, how it's been used, etc. I think most of you have a fairly good gut sense of what that would mean. It is an attempt to articulate a certain existential dimension of human life that is partly based on the reality, or at least so far, of a number of limitations on our knowledge, our range of action, our lifespan, et cetera, et cetera. Certainly one element of the human condition is our thrownness, and as Ron mentioned, in the sense that we suddenly just find ourselves in life, in a particular history, without much choice in the matter. And as Ron indicates, that will not stop, however much we become genetically modified individuals. On the other side of the spectrum, there's the ever-present looming specter of death, our knowledge that we are being unto death in Heidegger's term, and that there's not much we can do about that. Well, now maybe that's not quite so clear. So whether or not I accept the arguments that Ron would make about why I should embrace these kinds of technologies and ignore the sorts of lingering human issues, maybe some romanticism, some nostalgia, some sense of clinging to ideas of humanity, is that I have to live in the shadow, in the face of that possibility, that death, as I have been used to imagining it as a structuring principle of my consciousness, is not really going to play the same kind of game. Maybe I get to double my lifespan. Maybe, I get to live forever. And that question, that unknown possibility, begins to shape and change our sense of our ordinary existential reality. And that's kind of what I'm pointing to with the post-human condition. But there's another aspect of the human condition which does not change, or rather it expands and complicates itself, and that is the issue of choice. One of the fundamental aspects of the human condition is we're faced with decisions, and to the extent that we actually do really make choices and aren't just being motivated by things and telling ourselves that we're making choices, to the extent that we actually make choices, we don't know how they're going to come out, and we have to live with the consequences. And much of human adult life is engaging with the back blow of your decisions. And so there's obviously a tremendous amount of attention into decisions and the logic we go through to come to certain decisions and the reasons we have in order to shape those decision-making processes. And one of the things about the post-human condition is that it radically expands the field of choices. So the zone of choice itself becomes intensified, but the fundamental condition of not knowing the blowback remains the same. So it's a kind of intensification. Now, I want to just one note is like, why do I call this the post-human? You know, why, you know, there's a lot of discussion about, do we use transhuman? Do we use post-human? What do we mean here? And I use the term intentionally to invoke that dreaded notion of the postmodern. And I will not go too far in that. In many ways, it's a term that I'm happy to see, you know, date itself as we leave it behind us. But there's one element of the postmodern that I think is an important resonance here. One of the sort of great ideas, I think, out of a lot of postmodern thinkers is this idea of the loss of grand narratives, that human culture, consciousness, and history was previously organized by a number or even a very small number of grand narratives that most people in the society were able to more or less identify with. And that what you see in postmodernity is the situation of radical diversity of paradigms, points of view, worldviews, and suddenly this kind of confusing zone where we're supposed to be tolerant, but it's sort of confusing, and how do we educate between all these worldviews? You know, and it produces lots of effects in postmodern culture and in the literary theory and in the philosophy. And I think that's a very important dimension, a resonance here with the post-human condition, because one of the things that is challenged, one of the things that we're losing are these fundamental human narratives. What is a human life? What is a human? And these things become challenged and undermined and opened up and multiplied in an exhilarating and sometimes horrifying way. So rather than thinking about the debate, which is always kind of pulling you on one side or the other, we have these fantasies, you know, in the future there's going to be these wars between people who are, you know, ideologically solid. My sense is that the reality will be more of an ecology, a mixture of perspectives that all of us sort of find ourselves mostly probably somewhere in the middle, not in some kind of boring tolerance, let's balance sense, but in a confused balance of nostalgia or attachment to certain aspects of human life and an exhilarating openness and curiosity about the possibilities. So what do I bring to this field if I'm not trying to educate, if I'm not trying to create legislation, if I'm not trying to create norms? What I bring is a commitment to inquiry, which means that whatever condition arises, whether it's a scientific problem, the nature of consciousness, how much we can understand from the brain about how and why the self arises, or whether it's an existential or frankly spiritual question, the meaning of life, my relations with others, how I prioritize, how I experience my own consciousness, how I care for myself. These, for me, are all aspects of this question of inquiry. And I want to focus and have a little fun with the post-human condition and this question of inquiry by invoking a sort of primal scene for postmoderns or for post-humans, really, which is the scene in The Matrix where Morpheus offers Neo the choice of a red pill or a blue pill. So first, I just want to emphasize that this primal scene is about a choice, because one of the things that happens is that we are experiencing a multiplication and an onslaught of choices on both a tedious level, like there's a lot of commodities that I would prefer would just remain commodities and that I didn't have to make decisions about which one I want, actually. You know, the phone features thing, it's a bit much for me, frankly. I really don't want to have to deal with that. So there's a lot of trivial choices out there, but these trivial choices are only kind of the low shadow of much more significant choices that we'll face in reproduction, in terms of our own health, in terms of technologies, in terms of education, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that gives you a little sense of intensity about why we have this choice. Now, one comment about this, the role of choice, which comes up a lot, of course, in ethical and legal debates. You know, do people have a right to choose X or Y? And I'm not going to enter into that particular debate. I just want to offer a reflection. And the reflection is that as we more and more identify ourselves with choice and with the power or the agency that is exercised through choice, I believe we become less and less capable of richly inhabiting that part of ourselves that deal with that which we cannot choose and choicelessness, which are two different things. That which we cannot choose are those events which continue to arise in our life no matter how much control we exercise, which act more or less, let's say, as fate. And those things are not going to stop even if we multiply and exuberantly engage our choices. We're still going to have blowback, and we're still going to have chance, and we're still going to have disasters in our life, things that come out of nowhere, why me, all that stuff. And that the self who confronts that which we do not choose is an extremely rich and important part of the self. And sometimes I fear, perhaps a little bit like the bioconservatives, that in multiplying choices and in so emphasizing choice, we lose our ability to engage with that aspect of life. Choicelessness is another matter. That by that I mean something even a bit more mystical, which is that aspect of consciousness which is not involved in being an agent who is choosing, a tool maker, someone who is always manipulating in order to extend or produce more, have more pleasure, have more fun, live longer, live juicier, be more happy, all that stuff. That takes place, in my view, and this is just my view, in a domain of choicelessness, a kind of openness of the field that is a remarkable dimension to human life, and one in which is harder and harder to see the traces of, I believe, in contemporary culture.
You're listening to a talk by Eric Davis on May 26, 2006, at the Human Enhancement Technologies and Human Rights Conference, sponsored by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Eric was speaking on a panel with Ron Bailey and Bill Hurlbut about human enhancement technologies.
But let's get back to Neo's choice. So we have this red pill and blue pill, and you know the basic thing, the red pill, you wake up, the blue pill, you wake up in your normal bed, you know, it's everything's normal, it's just the same old life you've always lived, the life that's clearly an illusion. The red pill, will wake you up in a different world, but you don't know what that world is. When Neo makes his choice, he doesn't know what's going to translate, what he's going to discover, and of course he discovers something that's extremely difficult, traumatic, unpleasant, but unfortunately true. So it has that liberatory function of the truth. Now, of course, we don't really know which way we're gonna wind up. And the matrix can stand for many different things. It can be in a spiritual level, it can be the illusion, the maya of human life. On a cognitive science level, it can be the way in which we realize that our whole experience on a moment-to-moment basis is itself a kind of virtual reality produced through this interplay of sensation and cognition, and that to actually see through that matrix is to uncover something very profound about the self, but also very alienating. Or you can have a sort of lefty socio-critical analysis where the matrix is the sort of consensus reality, et cetera, et cetera. But what's really the crux here is the choice. And I'll leave it up to you, you know, how you decide about how to think about how to think about that particular choice, because confronted with any given pill, is it a red pill or a blue pill? Is that Prozac pill, a red pill or a blue pill? And why is it a pill? Why does Morpheus offer him a pill? Well, I would submit that Morpheus offers him a pill because pharmacology, neuropharmacology, psychopharmacology, offers us perhaps the best, and if not the best, then certainly one of the best models for grappling with the post-human condition, for the way in which we will actually, in the messy, screwed up, consumerist, lie-riddled world, make partial, ambiguous, ambivalent decisions about how we're going to change ourselves on a fundamental level. And, you know, I think it's extremely rich from this perspective of inquiry to contemplate and move into the possibilities opened by neuropharmacology, as many people have done in terms of the debates around Prozac, but to do so not in a way where you're a fundamentalist on either side, but instead you begin to recognize the mixtures and the nuances and the ambivalences that go around that decision. Because of course, if we're going to take SSRIs, there are obviously people who are just miserably suicidally depressed that are transformed by these things. Who but the most reactionary person would stand in the way of such medicine? But of course, as you all know, that the healing of the extreme is coupled with enhancement or the manipulation by people who are not in such extreme circumstances, and so then we find ourselves in the middle zone. I found myself in the middle zone because I have terrible anxiety sometimes. Terrible anxiety. Xanax is really cool. It's a really good drug. I mean, it really works well. I mean, it's a little addictive. I mean, I haven't gone there because I'm a little bit of a bioconservative when it comes to corporate pharmacology. But what I want to just sort of expand upon that a little bit is there's a fundamental mistake that the pro-enhancement people make often, which has to do with confusing ends and means or not recognizing the richness that is provided us by means. So we say the end is to achieve more happiness or to liberate myself from my anxiety, learn to live with my anxiety. So I can just take a pill. Or I can try something much longer and more tedious, which involves sort of meditation and some therapy and, you know, doing more yoga and like being more aware of how much sugar I had and all this kind of stuff. And like, you know, I haven't bested it. Anxiety is a demon that I sit with and is part of my family, and I accept. And there's a kind of tinniness or hollowness in the idea that simply by taking a pill and evaporating this condition that I'm really actually becoming happier. I'm not really sure about that. I don't know about that. It's certainly a place where I would like to proceed with inquiry. Finally, I would want to say that the issue of drugs, of the pill, also raises the specter of the non-legitimate zone of neuropharmacology, in that one of the ways to approach the issues that are going to be raised by enhancement technologies, particularly those enhancement technologies which enhance our ability to inquire about the human or the post-human condition. That's really what interests me here. It's not so much the things that are just going to make us live, but the ones that make us ask a question about who we are, what we want, and what does it mean to make a choice about those things, given that we won't really know what the blowback is. So this other zone of pills is, of course, the illegal realm of psychedelics, which we will be talking about later on in the conference. And it's an interesting model in the sense that I suspect it also gives us just a little flavor of what the reality might look like, the legal reality, the cultural situation of many of these enhancement technologies a couple of decades down the line, which is to say that there is a certain subset of the population that engages these things, many of them simply to do it for their own enhancement, their own pleasure, but a smaller subset to inquire, to understand, expand, meta-program, take the reins, experiment, push the boundaries of the self. And those things are illegal. Some people go to prison for them. But it's not quite illegal I was going to say embezzling because, of course, they let a lot of people get away with that one. But it's not like murder or rape, you know. It's on the border between being illegal and being sort of quasi-decriminalized. People go to jail for LSD, but a lot of people don't. And it creates this very strange kind of sort of petri dish of the culture, because one of the things you get when you don't have a legalized psychedelic, like a lot of people want legal, to legalize these things, is it becomes a kind of freer zone where the narratives that organize why and what those things are more free, are more open. It's one of the gifts of its illegal status, which, of course, comes coupled with tremendous pain for many people who are involved in it. And I kind of feel my way that something like this is coming down the pike, that this is stuff is not going to be just available at your corner store, and yet, of course, it's not going to stop. My hope is that we never lose the process of inquiry as we pursue more crude or, let's say, psychologically obvious goods, because it's in that process of both disenchanting the nature of the self so you understand its mechanisms and reimagining the self as it moves beyond its former prisons that we really still engage what is most productive and creative about the still human condition. Thanks.
That was a talk by Eric Davis, author of Technosis, Myth, Magic, and Mysticism in the Age of Information. He was speaking as part of a debate in the opening event of the Human Enhancement Technologies and Human Rights Conference held at Stanford University Law School on May 26th. We taped most of the panels and talks of that conference, so we'll be bringing you selected bits of that conference over the next couple of weeks, and you can listen to most of it pretty soon up on the IEET website. Now for a little techno-anxiety from nanotechnology expert Mike Treader, who is also the executive director of the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology and a fellow of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. This is his essay, Problems That Lie Ahead, from June 12th from CR Nano. We're approaching a period of perilous geopolitical instability, when weapons of mass destruction will be more varied, more deadly, more available, cheaper to obtain, and easier to hide. When the strength and ambitions of regional powers will increase rapidly, while the stabilizing might of the U.S. could be in decline, when new technologies such as genetic engineering, robotics, nanotechnology, and possibly artificial intelligence could enable radical shifts in the balance of power, and when global climatic conditions, including increased frequency and severity of killer storms, droughts, infrastructure damage, crop failures, and even whole ecosystem collapses will contribute to growing tensions. The global situation is becoming a vortex, a maelstrom in which multiple risk factors will swirl and combine to create sudden new crises for which we may not have time to prepare. The act of reaching into the vortex to grab hold of and deal with one problem could send others spinning in new, even more dangerous directions. It's a recipe for cataclysmic disaster. How dangerous it actually becomes will depend largely on how fast things happen. Will climate change devolve into sudden catastrophic shifts? With the ice caps melting, sea levels rising, and populations drowning? Could it occur, as some experts warn, over a span as short as 10 years? Will the looming peak oil crisis arrive within the next decade, or will new discoveries and techniques give us half a century to transition away from fossil fuels? Will nascent world powers like China and India find ways to resolve disputes peacefully, or will growing competition for resources spark into armed conflict? Will molecular manufacturing, perhaps the most transformative of all the emerging technologies, burst onto the scene before 2020 or even 2015, and without international agreements for safe and responsible use? Or will it develop more slowly and therefore less disruptively? All these questions await answers. A major challenge for us is to balance our warnings about the severity of the problems that lie ahead with encouragement for efforts to solve them. It's not easy to actually overstate the dangers. They are real, and they're really serious. But there's a fine line between awareness that leads to action and alarm that leads to despair. The world can't afford the latter. So we're pleased when someone else points out some of the things that concern us. For example, yesterday, Richard Weitz, a senior fellow of the Center for Future Security Strategies at the Hudson Institute, posted an excellent article online about security implications of climate change. His analysis illustrates the interconnectedness between apparently unrelated issues, and it reinforces the message delivered above, that numerous destabilizing factors are coming together at the same time. We're approaching a critical period in the history of humankind. The choices we make or don't make over the next 5 to 15 years could have consequences that will be felt for centuries to come. That was the article Problems That Lie Ahead by Mike Treader, a fellow of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and director of the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology. Now for a bit of the all-too-rare encouraging news. The struggle to base rights on personhood instead of irrelevant biological markers such as race is moving ahead in Spain, where the Spanish Socialist Party is proceeding to a vote to extend human rights to apes. According to the Daily Telegraph from London, Spain could soon become the first country in the world to give chimps, gorillas, orangutans, and other great apes some of the fundamental rights granted to human beings under a law being proposed by members of the ruling socialist coalition. The law would eliminate the concept of ownership for great apes, instead placing them under the moral guardianship of the state, much as is the case for children in care, the severely handicapped, and those in comas, said the MP behind the project, Francisco Garrida. Great apes held in Spanish zoos would be moved to state-built sanctuaries unless there was a risk that moving them would harm their emotional welfare, he said. The law would also make it a criminal offense to mistreat or kill a great ape, except in cases of self-defense or medical euthanasia. As a first step, Mr. Garrido, a Green MP for Seville, who sits with the socialists, will propose a resolution on the rights of great apes for the Parliament's Environment Committee at the end of this month. He said he expects the committee to approve the resolution, which already has received the public support of ministers. Mr. Garrido said he was confident that either the government or the ruling Socialist Party would introduce a great apes law after the summer recess. The legislation is opposed by the Catholic Church, and Amnesty International has expressed some consternation with it on the grounds that it's a distraction from human rights. If you're interested in the law and the logic behind it, you can read more at the Great Ape Project website at greatapeproject.org. Also at the IEET website this week, you can read a short reflection by Russell Blackford, an Australian bioethicist who is a fellow of the IEET, on this passage that he found from Leroy Walters and Julie Gage Palmer's book, The Ethics of Human Gene Therapy. He quotes it at some length and then reflects on it in an article there. The quote is, "A particular perspective on human nature clearly underlies our moral judgments about genetic enhancement. We are dissatisfied with and critical of certain aspects of the human condition as we see it reflected in the world around us and as we experience it. In the physical sphere, we regard disease and disability as evils that should be overcome as quickly and efficiently as possible. In the intellectual and moral sphere, we have also identified serious problems that should be addressed in multiple ways, one of which is the judicious use of genetic technologies. We think that a certain dissatisfaction with human nature as it has developed and as we have inherited it is a prerequisite for intervention to improve human nature. Also implicit in the notion of genetic enhancement is a dynamic rather than a static view of human nature. While there are historical and evolutionary reasons for human nature being as it is, we do not view the human race as being fated to accept the current state of affairs. Rather, we accept the possibility of change in human nature and have tried to argue for the ethical acceptability of certain kinds of planned changes in the characteristics of future human beings. In our view, such genetic enhancements are an important part of the overall task of attempting to provide a better life and a better world to our descendants." Again, that's a quote from Leroy Walters and Julie Gage Palmer's The Ethics of Human Gene Therapy, reflected on this week at the IEET website by Russell Blackford. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic future.